Thanks for joining us.
Talkline Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.
Welcome to the podcast. You are now tuned in to this episode of our podcast. Today we are going to interview some of the greatest and most influential minds in our field. And now, please welcome your host.
You're listening to Talk Line with Zev Brenner, America's premier Jewish broadcast on the air since 1981.
And we're back. It's always a delight to have Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Alan Avi Dershowitz on our program. Thank you for joining us. Thank you and your wife, lovely wife Carolyn, for joining us for Friday Night Shabbat dinner. We had such a wonderful time.
Oh, it was wonderful. Your family is unbelievable. It gave me such faith in the future to meet these young, brilliant, Orthodox people who are going to become, you know, the leaders, not only of the Orthodox Jewish community, but really world leaders. So you should be very proud of your family.
Thank you. Really was nice because you have so much knowledge about what's going on. In fact, I'm waiting for you to write a book. You've written over 50 books, but about the people that you've met and experiences you've had. I think it'll be a fascinating book. Is that in the offing?
Well, that would be a good idea. As you know, I just came back from Israel, where I met with the prime minister twice, with the president, with the head of the Mossad, and with some of the heads of the military. And I really learned a lot that you don't see on CNN. I mean, obviously, CNN has become Hamas central. Every single day, they have biased reports. Anytime an Israeli tries to defend anything, the hosts cut them off. But when somebody from Doctors Without Borders, which is really Hamas Without Borders, they never interrupt them. They let them go forward. They say whatever they say. They don't ask them hard questions. CNN has become an absolute disgrace. And it's part of the reason that people are dying. Hamas calls it the CNN strategy. That's their term. They kill babies by putting them in harm's way, expecting that CNN will show the dead babies and the world will turn against Israel. So CNN actually has blood on its hands. CNN is responsible for the death of civilians in Gaza.
No, I mean, a lot of culprits here. And in fact, I want to know, in past programs, Professor, you mentioned that you were a lifelong Democrat and, you know, well, you're this woman, Joe Biden, but he has to cross the line. Did he cross the line by telling Israel to have a ceasefire without demanding the return of the hostages?
Well, he claims that the ceasefire is part of a demand for return of the hostages. I have an open mind. This is the first time since 1960 when I voted for John Kennedy. First time I have not made up my mind. I might not vote for the Democratic candidate for president. It really depends. There's a lot of time between now and November, but he has to earn my vote. You know, the last communications I had with the great Joe Lieberman were just 2 hours before he fell and then died. And we were working on a joint statement that I then published in the Wall Street Journal the next day, in which we both said, look, you can't count on our votes. Don't take us for granted. You have to earn our votes. And that's my attitude. I have an open mind. The difference between Jews and supporters of Israel and opponents of Israel is they have nowhere to go. The Arabs and Muslims of Michigan, the crazy Hitler youth that are marching for Hamas, where are they going to go? They're not going to vote for Trump. They're not going to vote for Bobby Kennedy, who's very strongly supportive of Israel. We Jewish Zionist supporters of Israel and Christian supporters of Israel, we have some place to go. We could vote for Bobby Kennedy. We could vote for no labels. Some of us could vote for Donald Trump. So you better be careful about not mortgaging our votes to 200,000 voters in Michigan. You'd make a terrible, terrible mistake. That's the message I've been sending Joe Biden, and he's coming very close to crossing some lines.
Well, what line is that he has to cross? Because I thought that his statements where he talked about Israel has to unilaterally have to do a ceasefire and it would tie aid to Israel to performance. I think that certainly crossed the red line.
For me, red lines are in action, not in words. If he were to cut off any military aid to Israel, that would be a red line. And I would immediately announce my lack of support for him. Right now, it's heuristic. What he's saying is Israel has to open up some checkpoints. They have. Israel has to be more careful. They've issued a report. The report is very honest. It's not a final report. CNN has been spending as much time on this tragic mistake that Israel made with World Kitchen than they did on October 7th. They are creating a moral equivalence between an honest mistake, the kind of mistake the United States made In its exit from Afghanistan, the United States sent a drone after somebody it erroneously believed was a terrorist. He was a perfectly innocent guy. He got killed and his whole family was killed. One day story. CNN hardly covered it. But Israel makes a mistake and it's now into its third day and it's continuing and it's getting worse. CNN, as I said again, CNN has blood on its hands. If not for CNN, I think this war would have been over. I think the hostages would be returned. CNN is largely responsible for the continuation of this war by its biased coverage.
CNN, BBC, New York Times, I can list a whole litany of publications and media that are trumpeting the anti-Israel slogans and provoking the masses. And the truth is, what's happening here, I'd love to see the financial footprints, fingerprints of those that are giving money to support these demonstrators. These demonstrations don't happen out of thin air. Somebody's orchestrating it.
Where you shouldn't be sending money now, to Cardozo Law School. Cardozo Law School of Yeshiva University. So a group of Jewish students invited me to speak there. The dean said, no, Dershowitz is too controversial. So she refused to invite me. But the Federalist Society invited me. So I come to speak there just 2 days ago. And the radical left anarchist students all have signs up there. Dershowitz is a pedophile. Dershowitz is a rapist. Dershowitz is rapes children, all of that. And so I addressed that issue and, of course, explained that the woman who had falsely accused me admitted she may have misidentified me and withdrew her complaint. Still, they continued. They tried to shout me down. I made my case. They complained that I represented people they don't like, etc. Then the dean writes, and I also stood up against DEA, Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, saying it was a source of anti-Semitism. The dean then writes a letter in which she says the whole faculty supports DEA. I don't believe that. She doesn't speak for the whole faculty, but she supports DEA. She favors diversity, but not of opinion. She didn't want my views to be heard by the Cardozo students because she thought the Cardozo students weren't intelligent enough to hear my views and be critical of them. She was so insulting toward the Cardozo students by denying them the right to listen to controversial views. So she wants diversity of skin color, but she does not want diversity of opinion. As long as she is the dean of Cardozo Law School, I don't think people should contribute to that law school. The law school is becoming a centerpiece of DEI. DEI is the hotbed of anti-Semitism. She is a defender of DEI, and I suspect she has a litmus test. She was suggesting that the entire faculty supports DEI, which suggests to me that you can't get hired at the Cardozo Law School unless you accept this racist, bigoted, anti-Semitic, anti-equality notion that's destroying universities. I challenge her to debate DEI with me in front of our students. She doesn't have to do that, but I issue that challenge, and I issue a challenge to all Cardozo contributors. Do not contribute as long as this dean is conducting her business at Cardozo Law School in a way that denies freedom, that denies freedom of choice, that denies real diversity, and that substitutes equity, which is identity politics, for real equality.
So I was alerted to the Cardozo speech that you gave by one of our listeners who sent me a video of the speech, which I forwarded to you. Howard writes, Cardozo has a serious anti-Semitism problem and a critical thinking problem. I'm worried about the next generation of law students that will be making their way into our law offices and courtrooms. This is a long watch, but well worth it when you have the time. And Dershowitz spoke at Cardozo Group's events this week regarding Israel and anti-Semitism, ended up devolving to attack after attack on Dershowitz, the legal profession, of course, Israel. The event in Dershowitz were then left both mischaracterized and various students' LinkedIn posts. And I watched the video. In fact, there was one student who accused Israeli soldiers of raping Palestinian women.
Right. When I asked for data, she wouldn't support it. But the most important thing is a student videotaped it, and she issued a statement condemning the student for videotaping it. I gave permission to videotape my talk. I would hope the whole talk was videotaped. They only videotaped the Q&A part of it, not my talk itself. But what is she afraid of? She is the problem, and Cardozo is going to be turning out students that are part of the problem, not part of the solution. as long as she's the dean. So I'm going to start a campaign against contributions to Cardozo Law School as long as she's the dean. I had the same campaign about Harvard Law University when President Gay was Harvard, and we did cut down contributions. We have to fight back against this kind of anti-Semitism and bigotry. And when it comes to a place like Cardozo, which is obviously affiliated with Yeshiva University, I doubt the president of Yeshiva University knows what his dean is doing. I doubt that the donors to Yeshiva University know what the dean of the Cardozo Law School is doing. Again, I challenge her to the debate on DEI. I challenge her to the debate on whether there is anti-Semitism at Cardozo. And I challenge her to debate as to whether she is one of the causes of increasing anti-Semitism at Cardozo Law School. And if it's at Cardozo, it's coming to a law school near you.
Our guest is Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Professor Alan Dershowitz, Alan Avi Dershowitz. You mentioned Harvard. You know, my son-in-law is in Harvard, my daughter's in Harvard, and it was just about a week or so ago, they had an event which was not official, but it was unofficial, but with Harvard professors and students and Hamas speakers and supporting Hamas. This is going on. I have a video of Columbia University, my daughter's in Barnard, of where you have a protest, a Hamas protest, illegal, and the person in charge of safety doesn't want to address it. So we're seeing Jewish students exposed, and really nobody's doing anything about it. They're breaking the law.
Well, I agree with you, particularly at public universities, but even at private universities like Cardozo, if the dean had her way, she would ban me, she tried to, and allow anti-Israel and Hamas speakers to speak. When I speak, and I did this, you can see it on the videotape, I invite only questions that are critical. I don't want friendly questions. I had a half an hour to present my view, my pro-Israel view. Okay, now everybody in the audience has an opportunity to present their anti-Israel views. That's free speech. That's diversity, not what the dean of Cardozo Law School wants. She doesn't want diversity. She wants uniformity of view. She basically says it. She says the faculty stands behind DEI. I doubt it, and I don't stand behind DEI. And if any faculty ever try to hire me and make me say I support DEI, I would not take the job. I would quit. And I would urge others to do the same. DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, which does not include intellectuals, which does not include equality, the students walked out when I quoted Martin Luther King that I dream of a day when my children will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Students booed, and a whole group of students walked out. They were walking out on Martin Luther King. This is Cardozo Law School. Cardozo Law School is not a solution. It is a cause and a problem. And people have to look hard at Cardozo Law School and whether it should still remain in any way affiliated with Yeshiva University. It does not reflect the values of Yeshiva University. The students at Cardozo Law School, the pro-Israel students, tell me what a terrible time they have with faculty members, with the dean, with fellow students. That shouldn't be the case. The dean says everybody should get along at Cardozo, but everybody's not getting along. Pro-Israel students are being silenced, and a pro-Israel speaker like me, there was an attempt to silence me by the dean herself.
And then, so are you calling for, Professor, that Yeshiva University should divest itself from Cardozo Law School?
Well, I think they ought to at least think very hard. They ought to divest itself from this dean, certainly. She is part of the problem.
But you also have the students part of the problem, too. It's not just the dean, as the video.
Well, is what are the admissions criteria for Yeshiva? Is Yeshiva admitting people based on qualifications, based on the law school aptitude test, based on the ability to practice law? It didn't look that way yesterday. It looked like some of these people had no idea what it meant to be a lawyer. If Cardozo's admissions policies are based on illegal race preferences, that's something Yeshiva should look at, too. The Supreme Court has said you can't receive federal funds if you use race as a criteria for admission. And if Cardozo continues to use race, which the dean suggests she's doing, there ought to be a cutoff of federal funds to Cardozo Law School.
You mentioned free speech. I know you and I discussed at Shabbat dinner about Sid Rosenberg, the ABC radio talk show host. He was in Capitol Hill for the State of the Union address. And when the president was talking about numbers regarding the Palestinian casualties, he says who? He was escorted out. So shouldn't free speech and these laws be applied equally? Because other people cheered when they weren't supposed to be, and then shouted, "Hey, we're going to ride on" when the president spoke. So are we selectively enforcing what we're doing? Is that mean that you have, does he have a legal right to sue based on the fact that he was discriminated against?
Yes, and I've offered to represent him pro bono, and he sent me a shirt, a t-shirt that says who? Sid Rosenberg. Look, I grew up with says who. In Brooklyn, that was your answer to everything. People would say Mickey Mantle is better than Duke Snyder. We'd say says who? Better than Roy Campanella. Just says who? You know, says who was a very common statement, and I was so proud of Sid for saying it, because the president looked the camera in the eye and told an untruth. He said something like, of the 30,000 people who were being killed, the majority are civilians, or the majority are women and children. Not true. A false statement. First of all, what is a child? A child, as defined by Hamas, is a 19-year-old, an 18-year-old, a 17-year-old carrying an RPG and shooting and killing Jews. Yeah, they're children, but they're terrorists. What about women? Yeah, you can be a woman and be a terrorist. In Gaza, Hamas doesn't let a woman drive a car or have a profession except one profession. You can murder Jews. And so, yeah, let's assume that a certain percentage of the people killed were women and children. They were also terrorists. They were also members of Hamas. They were also collaborators with Hamas. And so Sid performed a great and important function by correcting the president, by standing up to power the way Elie Wiesel did when he stood up to President Reagan, when President Reagan went to visit Bitburg. And Elie Wiesel spoke truth to power. Sid Rosenberg spoke truth to power, and he got expelled from the House of the People. That should never happen. If you have a rule saying no comments, you know, but it would be like a judge. In a court, a judge can say silence, no response. But a judge can't say, I'm going to come down with a verdict now. If you support it, you can clap. But if you oppose it, you can't boo. No, that would be unconstitutional. And that's what Congress did to Sid Rosenberg. So
who do you sue in that situation? Who gets sued? Who gets sued in this situation?
Well, it would be for a declaratory judgment to declare the rule of Congress unconstitutional. You could sue the Congress itself. There's no immunity for an issue like this. Or you could sue the police who are in charge of administering it. There are lots of potential defendants. Nobody is suing for money here. We're suing for a change in the rules. You sue the same person if, for example, Congress passed a law in the 1800s saying only white people can sit in the gallery, not black people, or only white people can cheer, not black people. Clearly, there'd be somebody to sue. And when you have a rule that says you can only show support for the president but not opposition to him, and you can't raise critical questions. Remember, Sid didn't try to drown him out. Two words. That's who he sat down. That was it. That was the end. Not only was he removed, but a Gold Star father whose son was killed in Afghanistan was not only removed, but criminally prosecuted and arrested. And I've offered to defend him free of charge as well.
Well, we live in crazy times. And by the way, we had on this program Professor Abraham Winter, who's a specialized in statistics, and he shows statistically how Hamas made up these numbers, because it doesn't fly.
We know that. And the president of the United States shouldn't be quoting those numbers. You know, the New York Times stopped saying that the numbers come from the Gaza Health Society, which is Hamas. They don't say that anymore. They used to say that. Now they just give the statistic as if it's true. Bad reporting, bad journalism by the New York Times. The same New York Times that refused to report on the Holocaust. The same New York Times that opposed the establishment of the State of Israel. The same New York Times whose members are active in Temple Emanuel, which has been one of the most anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, and anti-Jewish places in the so-called Jewish community. Temple Emanuel, which won't allow me to speak about Israel, but pays Peter Beinart $25,000 to come and tell its members why Israel shouldn't exist as the nation state of the Jewish people. Shame on Temple Emanuel. They have become the CNN of synagogues.
So what do we do, Professor? Because we're going to be covering a program where they're actually having workshops to teach parents who are pro-Israel how to deal with their woke children coming home for a Passover Seder that are anti-Israel. What's going on?
I'm writing a book about that. The next book I'm writing is called Pro-Palestine Pied Pipers Are Leading Your Children from the River to the Sea, A Guide to Parents, because I'm hearing from all of my friends about their parents. I'm hearing from relatives about their children marching for Hamas. They don't know. They have no idea what river, what sea. They don't know the difference between Palestine and Palisades, but they're marching just the way many of them marched in the 1970s against the war in Vietnam. I was against the war in Vietnam, but some of these people were planting bombs. And remember, too, that at the anti-Israel demonstrations, look hard, the one thing you never see is a sign calling for a two-state solution or a Palestinian state, because they don't want, they just want there not to be a Jewish state. The other sign you see is down with America. Scratch an anti-Zionist and you're going to get an anti-American. Because a lot of these people are radical anarchists. We used to call them communists. That's no longer a term that's used, but it's the same people. Occupy Wall Street, the same anarchist people who want to do away with America, want to do away with capitalism, want to do away with the free market. Free speech for me, but not for thee. And, you know, there was one woman at Cardoza who asked a question. He said, why are you picking on me? I'm only 23 years old. I said, you know, 23-year-olds were the ones who led the marches for Hitler in Munich. 23-year-olds are the ones who brought Pol Pot to power and Fidel Castro to power and Stalin to power. Don't give me 23. 23-year-olds have been among the most villainous and dangerous people in our society. It's no excuse. You're old enough to drink. You're old enough to serve in the army. You're old enough to sign a contract. You're old enough to be responsible for your own perverse views, your own bigoted and anti-Semitic views. So don't give me the 23-year-old. You know, wake up and grow up.
Our guest is Harvard Law Professor Emeritus Alan Avi Dershowitz. Just as an aside, when we had you over for Shabbat dinner, one of the things I found intriguing about your relationship with Shlomo Kalbach of blessed memory, perhaps you'll share with our audience your relationship, and you've helped him.
Well, it started when I was a law school student, or maybe I was a young professor. I don't remember. It was Pesach. And my family went up to the Pioneer Country Club, Gartenberg and Schechtis, for Pesach. And on the first day of Chol HaMoed at night, maybe it was, I think, Motzei Shabbat, there was this guy playing the guitar in the lobby. And the owner, Mr. Gartenberg or Mr. Schechter, I don't remember which one, said, oh, no, get out of here. We didn't invite you. Get out of here. And somebody told Shlomo that I was a lawyer or a law student. And so I defended him. And I got Gartenberg and Schechter to allow him to play. And everybody loved him so much that he came back the next night. And then later on in life, I also gave him some legal advice. And, you know, we remain friends. And I'm a great admirer. I refuse to go to Central Synagogue where my wife goes. I go to Park East. We're a divided marriage. She's Reform. I grew up Orthodox. When she went to Central Synagogue, I refused to go when they banned the music of Shlomo Kalbach for a year. You know, his music is the most important Jewish music of the 20th century. And just beautiful, beautiful songs. People don't even know when they sing in shul melodies that have now become as familiar as Kol Nidre. They're not aware that they're Shlomo Kalbach memories. And I have to tell them that. And I love to go to the Kalbach shul when I go to Israel. And so I'm a big fan. I have his recordings and I sing along with him in the shower.
By the way, I don't know if you're aware of it, but when the Pope was in Central Park many years ago, one of the melodies sung was a Shlomo Kalbach melody. And Adina and I had breakfast with Cardinal O'Connor, who, by the way, was Jewish. People don't realize he was Jewish. But they were familiar with the music of Shlomo Kalbach. He was able to go beyond just even the Jewish community.
Well, go around the world, and I've traveled all over the world. I've heard Shlomo Kalbach's melodies sung in South Africa. I've heard them sung in Russia. I've heard them sung in China. I've heard them sung in Central America. I've heard them sung everywhere. He is the most important voice of Jewish melody and singing of the 20th century. And he should be remembered positively and fondly. And the worst thing is to accuse somebody of something after he dies when he has no chance to defend himself. But without regard to anything else, his music is phenomenal. And I'm proud to have known him and considered him my friend.
You have so many other interesting people. Who else? And I'm going to push you to write a book because you have such great stories and you're a wonderful storyteller. So I don't know why you don't write a book about all these. I think it'll be a bestseller.
Okay. It's a good idea. You know, when I get a little older, right now I'm still writing about Israel. But as long as Hashem gives me some strength and seichel, Beyond 85, which I am now. Maybe I'll have time to write that book. It would be an interesting book because I have met fascinating people in my life. I've also met some of the most boring people in my life who are very famous. You know, just because you're famous doesn't mean you're interesting. I've had to sit with some of the most famous people in the world and listen to drivel. And boring people, on the other hand, they have had, you know, people who are not famous have been fascinating. So, you know, I don't pick my people based on fame, but I've been lucky, fortunate to have met almost every important person, certainly every important person in Israel's history, from Ben-Gurion to the current leaders.
On a future program, I'd like to focus more on some of the great people, interesting people that you met. But I want to get back to Cardozo Law School for a few moments that we have remaining. And that is, have you reached out to the heads of Yeshiva University, to the dean, Rabbi Berman, or others to say what's going on in protesting what took place at Cardozo?
I'm going to, but I'm going to do it first in an article. I'm going to write an article detailing what happened, quoting what happened, and then I'll send it to the various people and fundraisers at yeshiva as well, and you know, let them take whatever action is deemed appropriate. It's up to them, not up to me. I did my thing, but I'm going to report on what I said and what happened and what the dean said and what an awful response and what an awful model she is for the future of law students. I would hope the students are better than she is.
Now, one of the students asked you a question during the question and answer, saying, would you defend American Nazis or people who are anti-Semites? Would you defend the Hamas individual? So what was your response?
If you don't defend the people who are unpopular, the next people who won't be defended are Jews. And that's what happened in the Soviet Union. When Elie Wiesel sent me to the Soviet Union in the 1970s, he sent me because nobody would defend Jews. When I defended Meir Kahane, nobody would defend the Jewish Defense League. And so it's important to defend everybody. And I did defend Palestinian students when they Harvard refused to allow the Palestinian flag to be flown after Arafat's death. I defended the students. I got the flag to be flown on condition that they allow me to hand out leaflets. And I handed out a leaflet as to how terrible Arafat was. And in the leaflet, I said that his death was untimely. If he had only died 4 years earlier, there might have been a Palestinian peace with Israel. But I defend people I hate, just like my grandchildren and my daughter-in-law, who are doctors, treat people they don't like. You don't pick and choose your patients or your clients based on their political views. And so I'm going to continue to defend people that other people don't like. And I'll defend some people that people do like, but that's not the way I pick my clients.
As an aside, by the way, Sinwar, who's the head of Hamas and the chief terrorist in the world today, was in an Israeli prison, and one of the doctors diagnosed him with having a certain condition, and they saved his life. And they recommend he shouldn't be released in a previous prison exchange. They didn't listen to him,
right.
And he's dangerous, but Israel saved his life.
No, I agree. I have a deal for Sinwar. If you surrender, I will defend you. If you surrender and turn yourself over to the Israeli authorities, they will put you on trial, and I will be your defense attorney. Deal? Got a deal? Come out with your...
We'll mention it. But is...
Got yourself a pro bono lawyer. I will fight Israel. I will defend you without cost, and I may even win. But you have to come out and surrender first, and then I'll be your lawyer.
Is there anybody you wouldn't defend?
Obviously. I wouldn't defend somebody who's a continuing criminal. Who would go back and commit more crimes. I draw a line there. I don't defend people a second time. I defend them only once. And I wouldn't defend anybody who hurt my family or endangered me if there was a conflict of interest. But in general, my rule, because I'm a professor with tenure, is I can't say no when I tell my students that everybody's entitled to a defense. I have to run, but it's great to talk to you. And please invite me again to share Shabbos with your family. It was a highlight of my time in New York. You're a wonderful family, and please send my best to the incredible cook you chose to marry, serve the most wonderful food, and produce some of the most wonderful children. And thank you for everything.
And thank you. Look forward to having you back again. Keep on the fight. And you're doing such a wonderful work for all of us. You're fighting not just for Jews, but for freedom of speech, democracy. That's the true value. But you embody the ACLU gave it up years ago. You still embody that.
ACLU giving it up. You need a civil libertarian. I hope I can serve that purpose. Thanks again. Take care.
Thanks so much, Dan. The great Alan Dershowitz here on the TalkLine Network.
Thank you for tuning in to
TalkLine with Zev Brenner, America's premier Jewish broadcast. The pulse beat of the Jewish community.
For continuous Jewish programs, talklinenetwork.com or our 24-hour-a-day listen line at 641-741-0389. For past shows, you can find us on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon, YouTube, Instagram, and all major podcast platforms or jewishpodcast.org. Thanks for listening to the talklinenetwork.com.
Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.